strange. Diversity.
Years have caused confusion.
Oh, trashiest moron.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another Office Hours. Just as people are trickling in, enjoying a Ramon Olones, a small club Corona. This shouldn't be too long, this stream. We're going to be talking about Gary Lineker. We're going to be talking about Israel and their ongoing war. Their Netanyahu's pledge to take Gaza, and the recent joint statement by the UK, France and Canada, directly related to Gary Lineker. And I'm going to be talking about what does this situation with Lineker and this statement portend? Does it signal anything wider? Is there a break or a possible break in the status quo ante that we have known our whole lives? Is the Boomer Truth regime falling apart at the seams? All of these are questions we're going to be tackling in the forthcoming stream. I've been really enjoying a game at the moment called Book of Hours, which is, I don't know if you've played a game called Cultist Simulator. Well, it's set in the same world, and it's by the same developer. But in this one, you're basically like putting together this old mansion and library and cataloging books. It's an amazing game. Can't stop playing it. I'll be back up to Swindon to see the old Lotus Munchers on Thursday. I had a good chat with Carl. I don't know if that's been released yet, but we had a kind of political chat there. I was actually mainly there to push Trivium, of course. You can buy Trivium here as well. Anything else as we're getting going? Lovely day. Enjoying a cup of coffee. If you're wondering, it's the Marks and Sparks powder, the powdered instant, forget what it's called now, but it comes in a metal tin. Of all the instant coffees on the market, I think that's the best one. It's actually meant for espresso, where I just make normal cups of coffee with it. All right, people are trickling in, so let's get it. Victoria Willing is a tea nationalist. Tea is much better. Funny, Carl Benjamin is one of those people who only drinks tea, does not drink coffee. I like both, of course. I think they serve different purposes. My grandmother, bless her, while she was alive, was one of those classic British women who had to have a cup of tea to come in. I can't settle down until I've had a cup of tea, she'd say. And then she'd have a cup of tea before she went out. There was like tea was her coming back to, like, she had it as preparation for anything, just before going out, just after coming in. It was just like it punctuated every aspect of the day. My mother is also a bit like that, but not as much as my grandmother. I like both tea and coffee. I think they serve different purposes. Why am I having a coffee? Because I was feeling a little bit, I had a lunch and I was feeling a little bit that post-lunch lull. So there we are. Since last we spoke, I suddenly got big in India. I say big in India. Last Thursday, a chap from Australia was meant to be covering the Australian elections in a guest video. And at the last minute, he pulled out. He said, I've been too busy. I haven't been able to do it. I was like, okay. So I was like, I don't know anything about Australian politics. What am I going to make a video on? And I thought, well, why didn't I just share this little meditation technique I do called the fourfold breath elemental exercise? And I released it and it absolutely bombed. Nobody bloody watched it. And then all of a sudden, some time over the weekend on Friday, it started getting like tens and thousands of views. I was like, what the hell's going on? And I had a look and all these views were coming in from India. And I even like messaged where the bloke I'm in touch with, the YouTuber, what's going on here? And anyway, it turns out that my meditation video somehow trended on the front page of YouTube India, where they're into elemental kind of, I guess they call it, was it prana yoga or something like that? I mean, my technique is not from yoga. My technique is from a different tradition. But yeah, anyway. And then somehow all those people hitting that meditation video caused them to watch some other videos too. They watched my China one and they watched a few others. So yeah, I had a lot of hundreds and thousands of views over the weekend. Anyway, if you're one of those Indian watchers, good day. Hello. I apologize for anything I may have said about your compatriots in the past. I love the people of India. You know, my dad is from Iran, Persia, and many great cultural exchanges over the centuries. Saffron, for example, and various other spices were introduced into the Indian cuisine by the Persians during their time there. Many other great things went up and down that Silk Road over the years. It's just like nothing against the great nation of India. But if you are watching Indians, you know, have a look at the map. Look how big India is. Look how big and beautiful. It's a big, beautiful country, right, in the Indian Ocean. And look how small the UK is on the map. 1.2 billion of you. Not that many Brits. You don't need to come here. There's nothing here for you at all. It's busy. It's crowded. You know, I was talking about coffee. You try getting a coffee in London. Queue out the door. Can't get anything you want on time. Potholes everywhere. Just don't bother coming. You'll have a much better time in your own country. I saw a piece of news recently. 38,000 Indians, Indian women, have decided to set up a community because they were feeling lonely and alienated living in this country. The island of strangers that Keir Starmer talked about in real life. And I couldn't help but think, like, look, there's one place that you could have a community all to yourselves, a country made just for you. And that's called India. It's your homeland. There's a lot for you there. There's nothing for you here. Nothing for anyone here. So anyway. Anyway, if you're from India, welcome, welcome. If you're wondering if I have any other meditation techniques, I do have a few. I do have a few other ones too. But that's the baseline, the elemental fourfold breath. I'm going to be recording some shorts soon. I want to get this business with the Lotus Eaters out of the way before I start doing some like proper recording. I'm going to record some shorts. I've got a few things I want to talk about when it comes to their kind of life advice type stuff, which, you know, has a slightly different audience. One of the things I want to talk about, for example, is how people get stoicism right, wrong. The idea of bottling up your emotions or controlling your emotions versus reaching a kind of mental state where you can let your emotions unfurl and simply observe those emotions like passing clouds. Okay? You can't run away from them and you can't fight them, but you can treat them as a kind of neutral observer. And I'll be talking about that and many other things. I want to talk about the power of words. the power of saying words out loud. There's all sorts of things I want to talk about in those shorts, because it's been a while since I've done them, so these kind of ideas percolate. Let me just go and get my ashtray a second, and then we'll talk about Gary Lineker. In fact, while we're waiting, I'll play one of the ads. Which one shall I play? Let's do the rhetoric one. I'll play the rhetoric one in full, the full 3 minutes of it. And then when I come back, we are going to talk about Gary Lineker. Have a word.
Friends. Romans. Countrymen. Shh. Come this way. Lend me your ears. Secrets of ancient rhetoric can now be yours for a trifling sum. The art of persuasive argument is all around us. In fact, we are surrounded by it. We live in a rhetorical age, but this is seldom taught and even more seldom explained. It is not for you to know, they said. The master of grammar knows how to write with clarity, precision, and correctness. The master of logic knows how to disarm his opponents with reason alone, and both can be powerful adversaries. But the master of rhetoric can outflank both, caring as he does little for their rules and even less for their defeated tears. The master of grammar asks, is this sentence correct? Is this sentence clear? The master of rhetoric wonders, does my speech have the power to sway the passions? Can my words move the crowd? Yes, it can. Yes, it can. The master of logic trains his mind to eliminate fallacies and formulate correct and well-defined arguments. The master of rhetoric knows that the reasoning mind can be flooded with emotions, that the flood can short-circuit logic and overwhelm his opponent, who will crumple. They will wonder why their well-written, well-reasoned arguments were so defenseless against the rhetor's apparent ability to bend reality to his will. Do the faces in the crowd not see through this dark magic? The master of rhetoric laughed at their wonder. He looked at the bemused, despairing face of the master of logic and spoke. Harness that wonder, my friend. It was your own beloved Socrates who said, the only true wisdom is in knowing that you know nothing. And wonder is the beginning of wisdom. He turned to the master of grammar. So lucid and correct your prose, but why does nobody listen to you? It was your own favorite, George Orwell, who wrote, perhaps a lunatic was simply a majority of one. Do not rail at the crowd for what is in their nature. Understand what they are, and they will listen to you. And with that, the master of rhetoric was gone. Find out what else he has to say by signing up to Foundations of Rhetoric. Fulfill your destiny and complete the trivium.
All right. Very rarely gets a full play, that ad. So, but anyway, since we're talking trivium, I thought I'd let you have it. So, Gary Lineker played a long time for Leicester City, for Barcelona, for England, of course, scorer of many goals, and famously never picked up a yellow card in his entire career. Very clean-cut character is our Gary, England hero. And then, of course, he took over from Des Lynam as the main presenter on Match of the Day. Probably more than 20 years ago now. He's been the presenter of Match of the Day for a good while now. Can't remember exactly when old Des moved. I think Des Lynam moved to ITV, did he? But basically, it's been Gary Lineker as the face of BBC football coverage for 20 years. And I know a lot of people in the political scene don't watch football. I mean, I don't watch football anymore, but I used to watch football. But this is like not insignificant. It's a significant thing. And Gary Lineker is, you know, whatever you, whether you love him or hate him, you probably hate him, is a significant cultural figure in this country. Let's not beat around the bush. So what was it that caused Lineker to leave the BBC? Well, believe it or not, he posted like some criticism of Israel, you know, bombing Palestinian kids or whatever. And the thing that he shared had a little rat on it, right? And so there was a hullabaloo that this rat that was on this meme was an anti-Semitic trope. And therefore, Gary Lineker, you know, has to go, okay? And then Gary Lineker apologized for posting it and immediately resigned. Didn't take any, like, leave. He just immediately parted ways, announced his resignation. That's it, okay? Now, there is more to this story than meets the eye in every single respect, okay? For one, we'll get into all of the aspects of it, okay? First thing I'll say, because I think it's worth actually saying these things out loud on occasion, all of the shit that Gary Lineker has said, the erstwhile crisp salesman, the face of Walker's Crisps, he has been an absolute gobshite for the past decade, right? He during BLM, during all of the culture war bullshit, he was woke, he was leftist, he was always sticking his stupid political opinions all over England coverage and in his Premier League coverage. And not a dicky bird, right? He never once faced disciplinary or got into trouble for it. But now he basically accurately points out that since October the 7th, which was what? I mean, almost 2 years ago now, that the Israelis have been, you know, let's not beat around the bush. They've been bombing women and children, like, relentlessly for about 2 years. And Netanyahu's come out and said, we're going to finish the job. Our aim is to take over all of Gaza. Okay, he's come out and said that now. It's confirmed. That is their aim. Keir Starmer and Macron and the Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, issued a joint statement earlier today where they condemned Israel, said that if they don't stop this bombing, and if they don't get aid to starving children, there's going to be sanctions coming from Britain, France, and Canada. Netanyahu reportedly has fallen out with Trump. How much of that to believe? I don't know. Frankly, who can tell with the Trump White House what the hell is going on, you know, 9 times out of 10. But it does seem like there's friction behind the scenes. At the very least, there are two camps in the White House between, you know, the let's say the Marco Rubios of this world, and the people who are still like fully invested in toadying to the lobby, and there are America firsters, let's just say, within the Trump team, okay, and they seem to be arguing. One of the oddest aspects is that this guy Steve Witkoff appears to be in the America First camp, despite his background, whereas Marco Rubio appears to be in the, you know, in the neocon camp, you know, despite his background. So it's kind of like, you know, there's no rhyme or reason. I mean, I saw a speech by Kemi Badenoch earlier today, where Kemi Badenoch was talking as a kind of blood and soil nationalist for Israel. You know, so she'll say that on one day, and then on another day, of course, Kemi Badenoch will be like, oh, well, Britain is a nation of immigrants, right? How they square that, I don't know. But the point is, Kemi Badenoch is from Nigeria, right? She has no, like Marco Rubio, she has absolutely no kind of biological connection to that country in the Middle East, and yet she still says this sort of stuff, right? So the point I'm making is that where a person's background is not indicative of where they fall on that topic, is what I'm trying to say, okay? It's not an easy and fast rule. There is a split also between, let's say, the Zionists and the reformed what they call the Reformed Jewish community in America, certainly, and even in Israel on this question. So it's not like a necessarily split along those lines. It's split along ideological lines. So that's something I wanted to say. But it's worth noting that Gary Lineker, who is, you know, has very super clean cut credentials, has ostensibly left the BBC for criticizing Israel. Now, there's so much more to this story I want to talk about other than just the Israel bit, but I wanted to get rid of, I wanted to get kind of past that up front. There is this, there's something interesting happening, right? There's something interesting happening, which is that I think people are getting more and more on the left now I'm talking about, they're getting more and more bold in their moral condemnation of Israel. They're getting more, they're getting less and less scared of speaking out. I was quite interested to see the Navarra media coverage of this because, well, you're going to see a little bit from Gary Lineker. There was actually the précis by Ash Sakar that interested me. Now, let's see if you can see, populist delusion fans, why I was interested in the words of Ash Sakar.
I shared a post here on Instagram that contained an emoji that has awful connotations. Unfortunately, I did not see the emoji. If I had, I would never, ever have shared it. I think it's best for all concerned that I step down from BBC presenting duties altogether. The relationship with the BBC has been long and wonderful, but it's the right time for the organisation and myself to go our separate ways.
Every time Israel escalates the material harms which it visits on the Palestinian people, we somehow end up talking about something else. The reason why this is because you have a highly organized, well-networked, interlinked series of groups and individuals whose only purpose is...
Highly networked, interlinked series of individuals and groups.
To flood organizations with complaints, to force them to modify their coverage of Israel, to minimize, to self-censor when it comes to that coverage because they don't want to be accused of anti-Semitism, and to subject certain individuals to suffocating levels of scrutiny to try and drum them out of public life. We've seen this happening when it comes to much lower profile individuals. And of course, Gary Lineker, because of his prominence, has long had a target on his back.
Last week.
Now, this is pretty interesting because, you know, Gary Lineker is pretty much as high profile as you can get in this country. You know, the presenter, the face of BBC football, ostensibly leaving the organization over anti-Semitism. However, I actually think that this is not really the story. It is not really the story, okay? It's annoying that Israel is the issue over which Gary Lineker, who's been long a thorn in our sides, given his virtue signaling on every other topic under the sun, okay? It's kind of annoying that this is the issue he's gone over. But, you know, there's a difference between what you might call a hard cancellation and a soft cancellation, okay? This, friends, is a soft cancellation. What do I mean by that? What I mean is Gary Lineker is not done, right? Gary Lineker is not going to retire and go and play golf, you know, into the sunset. Gary Lineker is being set up to do something else. I read several newspaper articles taking odds on what Gary Lineker is going to do next. And the bookies are currently taking odds of 2-1 of Gary of Lineker presenting the ITV World Cup coverage in 2026. Okay. The director general of the BBC says Gary has acknowledged the mistake he made. Accordingly, he will have agreed to step back from further presenting after this season. Gary has been a defining voice in football coverage for the BBC over two decades. His passion and knowledge, right? That's not a cancellation. That is not Gary Lineker is a vile racist. You should never be seen or heard of again. It's a soft landing for Lineker, okay? So that's one thing that I wanted to focus on. Because while it's true what Ash Sarkar said, that there is this, you know, organized group who lobby and barrack people who criticize Israel, it's obvious that the power of such people is massively on the wane. It's on the wane in America, as we've seen with the stuff like Dave Smith versus Douglas Murray and all of that kind of fallout and everything that's been happening over there. You know, and on the extreme end, like Kanye West literally, you know, dropping, you know, videos praising the mid-century Germans and so on. I mean, right, there is a clear erosion, right, of the taboo of the of power, right, on that side of things in America. But also in this country, Gary Lineker basically, like, what happened really is that he got this man here on the left, okay, is the sports director of the BBC, and he's new, right? He's called, the sports director of the BBC is called Alex K. Jelski, okay? Alex K. Jelski. This is the guy on the left here. And he came in last year with a remit to shake up the BBC sports department, specifically with a view of getting presenters to stop opining on political topics during things like the World Cup, Wimbledon, blah, 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 okay? He is, by the way, the first openly gay sports director of the BBC, right? But despite that, he's come in with this kind of remit to get the likes of Lineker to stop opining on political topics, okay? And Lineker didn't like this. He was like, I'm not going to listen to this little gobshite, okay? I'm not going to listen to this twerp. He's about half my age. Two, you know, from his point of view, his political views are the neutral point of view, is the impartial. Like, he is not violating the BBC's charter simply by telling the truth, right? And, like, so, for example, on the issue of Palestine, if Israel are, like, blowing up children, that's not a political issue. That is just a fact, according to Gary Lineker, okay? So this is the argument. So basically, beef had been brewing between these two for quite a while. And Lineker was set to go after next year's World Cup anyway, right? He was basically in his last year of contract, and he was set to actually leave the BBC after that. All that's happened is that this incident with the rat has accelerated the timeline. So he's leaving now as opposed to after the World Cup next summer, okay? And so clearly, Lineker was already at 1 foot out the door. So this is really what's going on. It's like a power struggle between these two individuals. And Lineker was like, I am not working under these new conditions. Okay. So that's why he's being given this soft landing. The anti-Semitism line is basically an excuse to get to for him to go, right? The other thing to note about Gary Lineker, and this is why I think this story is more interesting than it appears, is that Gary Lineker is not just a former footballer and TV host, right? He is actually the owner of this podcast empire, right? So they've got a number of shows, including The Rest Is Politics, which is Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart, where, I mean, I've been listening to that recently, and they criticize Israel all the time on there, all the time. Like, practically every other episode is an Israel bashing session, okay? The Rest Is History is his. He's got 13 of them. You can see all of these shows. It's basically like Shitlib Central. It's like the centrist dad network. They've got a US version with Anthony Scaramucci as the host and Katy Kay. They've got, I mean, yes, they've got football content, they've got money, they've got economics. Look at Robert Peston presents for him. You know, Alan Shearer, Micah Richards are there, right? This is a big podcast network, right? It's super mainstream. All of these shows are like number one, two, or three in the in their respective fields, right? In this country. So, what am I driving at here? What's really interesting to me is that it's possible that Gary Lineker can stop being the host of Match of the Day and stop being in front of the BBC coverage and actually have become a louder voice. It's possible that this is not a cancellation, but it's an enhancement. It could actually make him more political. It could make him a louder, you know, it could make him an even bigger force, right? Without the BBC to answer to. You understand what I'm saying? Because he is a significantly powerful media figure, a media mogul, you might say, a podcast mogul. Why is this interesting? Because to go back to Ash Sarkar's point, the old power structure, which was very top down, very centralized, was like, look, if the director of the BBC says you're out, you're out. If the director of the BBC answers to this country or this set of political interests, guess what? You're going to have to toe that line. Well, if you're Gary Lineker and you own your own podcast empire, how about no? How about I don't have to listen to those rules anymore? Exactly the same as if you're Joe Rogan and you have the Joe Rogan podcast empire, right? Well, I mean, think of how many people went on Joe Rogan basically to tell him off for the guests he's had on. Right, they literally went on there and told him off for having on guests who were critical of what Israel are doing. Right, a concern trolling. Yeah, you're going to concern troll Joe Rogan. And in the same way that Joe Rogan won't be concern trolled, I've got a funny feeling that Gary Lineker won't be concern trolled either when push comes to shove. I wouldn't be surprised to see Restless Politics intensify their kind of anti-Israel messaging, if you want to put it that way. Why this is interesting is that a lot of people listen to that show, The Restless Politics. They have very, very big numbers. And if you step out into normie world, the views of like many average Joes are basically formed by the likes of The Restless Politics. Okay, there is now such a wide disconnect or disconnection between the country and the leadership over this one issue of Israel that it threatens to undo an awful lot. It threatens to undo an awful lot because the left have got more and more monomaniacal on this topic. The other day I went, I was thinking of like some old friends of mine I knew from back in my lecturing days. I wonder what these people are up to. And they're all just basically 24/7 Palestine. All of that, that's all they do, 24/7, is Palestine post, right? Pictures of dead bodies, pictures of children, rants against Netanyahu, rants against our government, attacks on Keir Starmer for not, like, denouncing Israel, blah, blah, blah. That's all they do now. Okay, I mean, all of the other issues, green shit, the rich, all of it is secondary now, on the left, I mean, to this one issue. Owen Jones, if you have a look at his timeline, that's all he does. 24/7, that's all they do, is post about Palestine, okay? I mean, yes, it's frankly, it's tiresome. I get bored, same as you, right? But I'm just saying, like, there's a lot of people who do that. There's a lot of... Now, you can do an awful lot top-down, right? There's a lot of elastic in the top-down mechanism. But there are limits to the top-down mechanism. There are actual limits to how much you can simply impose, right, through the mechanisms of, you know, cancellation, control of this network or that network. And with the internet and with YouTube and with really, really famous people you know, whether it's Joe Rogan or Gary Lineker, or at the very extreme end, somebody like Kanye West, they're not able to control these people in a way that they used to be. Okay. A lot of younger people, a lot of Zoomers are just used to this culture. You go back to the early 2000s, for example, and it was you wouldn't get the kind of level of criticism and condemnation and kind of open talk about this as an issue that you get today. Now, granted, back then, there wasn't the sustained two-year kind of humanitarian crisis that there has been. They did have campaigns back then. I remember Ariel Sharon, and there was the occasional kind of speech by Harold Pinter and some of the anti-war lot, but it wasn't anywhere near as rampant left and right as it is today. And I just wonder about at what point, or has there been the tipping point, to use a Malcolm Gladwellism, right, where the incentives of all of these people, whether you're Gary Lineker or Donald Trump even, right, even Donald Trump, who will be thinking about this right now, are the incentives to carry on the support no matter what strong enough to endure? Or are we going to get a point where the counter incentives to not go along with it, to actually be with the people who criticize it, is that going to actually start to carry a greater moral weight, and the incentives are going to be too strong in that direction? That's a question to be asked. When the conflict first started to really escalate, I remember writing an article saying, like, is the woke going to put the Zionism away? And then it seemed like I was getting that question answered really, really quite soundly. The answer was no, Zionism will put the woke away. The answer is no, our power will get its own way no matter what. The answer was no, they're just going to get away with whatever they want to do. And anyone who says anything about it is going to be fired, is going to be cancelled, is going to be hounded out of public life, blah, blah, blah. Okay. That seemed to be the answer loud and clear, right? Nobody's too big to be cancelled over this issue. What power says rules, morals, schmorals, ideology, schmideology, what we want happens. That's what it seemed like what was happening. However, we're now another year on, okay? It's getting to be, like I said, 2 years almost coming up. And I feel like the weight of the negative sentiment is starting to get too great to manage. And I'm interested to see how this plays out. Because I really doubt, I cannot see Gary Lineker, who's now lost his cushy job at the BBC over this, ostensibly, suddenly doing like the tour of Auschwitz. He's not going to stop running his mouth on this topic, I'd have thought. He might go quiet for a couple of months, but he'll be back. He'll go and talk to Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart, and they'll talk about, you know, the what they call genocide happening in the Middle East right now. Joe Rogan doesn't like being told what to do by all of these people who come on his show. Imagine the gall of going on somebody else's show and saying, why did you have that guest on? How dare you talk to that person? I don't like what you said about that. I mean, like, who do those people think they are? They're sticking their nose in, basically. They're saying, actually, you have a right to free speech, but you don't have a right to free speech on this one topic. And this is the problem that some of this tactic of the anti-woke, right, the quote-unquote anti-woke but hardcore Zionist is going to come across in the coming year or 2 years. Because anybody with a working brain cell will be able to see, hold on a second, I'm allowed to say this. I'm even allowed to be racist if it's against these people. I'm allowed to talk about race and IQ. I'm allowed to do this. I'm allowed to do that. But I'm not allowed to have views in this one area. The Schmittian exception, you might say. And this is as long as it exists as an unprincipled, and that's a key word, the unprincipled Schmittian exception, as long as that exists, it's going to be a persistent problem because people are going to keep on coming up against it, coming up against it, and coming up against it. And rightly, they'll start to wonder, hold on a second, I can say all this stuff. I'm allowed to criticize this group and that group and that group and that group. But I can't say that. And also at the same time, all of these friends of mine on the right who have been cancelled for speaking out against BLM or speaking out against this woke mantra or saying that only men can have penises or COVID or whatever other issues people on the right have been cancelled for, at some point they'll start to realise, hold on a second, all of these woke leftist people, even quite powerful ones, they've been cancelled too. Even Gary Lineker's been cancelled now. There's probably as many leftists who've been cancelled as writers who've been cancelled. Why were the leftists cancelled? Oh, right, it's because they were critical of Israel. Weird. We were cancelled for these reasons, those were cancelled for those reasons. But that shows that there's things they can't say over on that side too. What's the common denominator? Only a matter of time before those conversations start to happen. Only a matter of time before Joe Rogan, who has many leftist friends, of course, starts to have those conversations in real life. And then he'll start to have them on camera. And then other people will start to have them on camera. And all of a sudden, you'll get a cascade of all sorts of people talking about exactly what I just laid out. And, this, I would say, is a massive problem. It's a massive problem because the longer it goes on, the more what I call the boomer truth regime. What is the boomer truth regime in short, right? What is it in short? The boomer truth regime in short is you, as a person of European heritage, whether you're living in America or in Europe, you as a person of European heritage, you're not allowed nice things because Hitler. Because Hitler, you can't do this, 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 and this. That's basically what the boomer truth regime boils down to at the end of the day. And that argument is starting to lose its weight rapidly and in real time. It's starting to lose its weight. The taboos around it are starting to fall off. And people are starting to say, well, look, you can't rest on that, you know, atrocities that happened 80 years ago when you're committing atrocities today in real time and it's being broadcast around the world. I watched John Mearsheimer on Judge Knapp the other day, and they played this clip of the Israeli defense minister. And Mearsheimer, who's a boomer, who's a liberal, just coldly looked at the camera after it finished and said, it's almost like he was a Nazi, wasn't it? Nazi could have easily said that. And that's the trouble. You've set up a moral paradigm where these sorts of things are beyond the pale. You've set up a moral paradigm where you're just not allowed to go to certain places. And then, using an unprincipled Schmittian exception, you're then trying to do that, do exactly what is prohibited, while also trying to maintain the moral high ground, the moral legitimacy. And frankly, it's not working at all. It hasn't worked on that front. And I still wonder, I don't know the answer as to how it's going to go. I just wonder how long it can hold. It doesn't seem to be a sustainable situation because, I mean, you can't cancel everybody. And sooner or later, all of the cancelled people will just be like, hold on a second, we've got more fans than you. We've got more money than you guys. We've got, you know, like, you know, I don't need your network anymore. I don't need, like, this, you kind of dangling threats over my head. How about no? Ah. And just like that, you have no power over me. You have no power over me. And that's it. The whole moral paradigm is changed. It's over. Now, this is a big thing that's happening in real time. And I'm sure that there are people, even people in Israel, who know this, who understand exactly what I'm talking about, and are currently being like, how the hell are we going to manage this? And I thought for ages that what they might do is to try to, like, put it all on Netanyahu, localize the evil, and make it all him, right? The trouble is, the longer this has gone on and the more indefensible it has got, it's actually exposed. It's exposed in real time those people who are part of that network. So now somebody like Douglas Murray is damaged goods. Let's face it, he's damaged goods. And it's not just him. It's a lot of other people too. Because on any given topic, most people have a natural response to whatever it is. And then you've got, like, paid shills like Murray, or people who come out and defend Murray, and everybody's thinking, like, hold on, like, that's not a normal reaction. Why have you only got 700 likes on this, and why are you being massively ratioed by all of these people, all of these other people who I follow? Were you just not organic all along? Like, what's the deal here? And again, unless they do something about, unless something changes soon, I think it's it. I think it's basically like all, like, double or quits, you know, all or nothing, which is a peculiar feature of a certain type of Middle Eastern thinking. This is something that Oswald Spengler talks about, this kind of binary, it's like dark or light, good, evil, all, nothing. It's like a really binary mindset where, you know, there's like, can be no compromise. Even a single compromise I make is basically like, you know, might as well be Hitler, basically, or you might as well. And it's so extreme, and it's so, uncompromising is the word, that something's got to give, right? Something's got to give. And I feel like, I saw a BBC headline saying, like, goodwill has drained away. Goodwill has drained away. When you're talking about sympathy for the Holocaust, which is ultimately what we're talking about, when we're talking about, from a starting point of basically having, like, the entirety of Western society on side, right, in the aftermath of World War II, with the defeat of the Nazis, right? That was a massively strong position to start from. To talk about, like, the last of the goodwill draining away, I mean, it's remarkable how quickly that has happened. I've got a video coming out. I've got a video coming out soon on Steven Spielberg. Trying to remember when it's coming out now. Spielberg. That is coming out tomorrow. Like, I've got my video on Spielberg coming out tomorrow. What's really interesting to me is, like, so a figure like Steven Spielberg will never have the cachet that he enjoyed in the 80s and the 90s now or again. They have, like, such a central, culturally central position, moral and political and cultural capital. And it's like the actions of Netanyahu and the actions of Israel have basically, like, more or less destroyed it. It's actually a combination of two things. It's that coming from the Israeli right, And then also it's the woke stuff in Hollywood. It's the moral hectoring of the woke era in general has kind of killed Hollywood. That's not Steven Spielberg's fault, obviously, but you know, that has happened too. Although, as I'll be talking about tomorrow, Spielberg was, you know, Spielberg was always woke, in my opinion. All right, I think that'll do on Gary Lineker. I think that'll do. Why don't I now get to some super thanks and some super chats? And then we'll get out of here. It'll be a little goblin raid. So, super thanks. Starting now with a week ago. So, last week, 6 days ago, Studio Rayner said on the nuclear bomb paradox, accepting MAD is simpler than accepting a preemptive nuclear attack with a winner. Nuclear deterrence fails if the public doesn't believe or care about being killed in a nuclear attack. During the Cold War, Europeans were ideologically subverted to accept a sacrificial role in a nuclear war. That was the official US military doctrine. In terms of nuclear blackmail, it's fairly evident that after Israel obtained a nuclear arsenal, their influence over Europe and the US was heavily bolstered. Israel disregards the international order given the Samson option. It's undeniable why the US must unconditionally support Israel. I don't think the support is due to the Samson option, to be honest. Each generation since the invention of the atom bomb has become more decadent than the prior generation. This phenomena isn't a paradox. It's the human reaction to realizing a power beyond control, leading to dismissal, like dismissing a solar flare or asteroid. To avoid this reality, those in power become deceased, and those not in power have no reason to ignore what's beyond their control. All of that sounds right to me, apart from the bit about Israel being supported due to the Samson option. I will say, though, that video of mine, Nuclear Bomb Paradox, was basically talking about how, like, nobody can actually use it, though, and the actual use of a nuclear bomb automatically loses you the world, if that makes any sense. So you can use it to win conflict quickly, but then, like, the rest, like, imagine if Putin nuked Kiev, right, which is, let's face it, they're at war in the realms of possibility. He would, like, win the war, but he'd also, like, lose, like, he'd be globally condemned immediately, and possibly, like, the rest of the world just would immediately declare war on Russia. So I'm not sure if, like, and because of that, then Russia won't actually use the nuke. And because everybody else knows that, everybody else can then act as if Russia will never use the nuke. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's like the opposite of MAD, is that there's like a kind of world where everybody realizes that MAD is too mad, and therefore everybody knows that nobody else is going to use a nuke. I don't know what you call that, but that's what I was getting at in the nuclear bomb paradox. Alphonse writes again on last week's Office Hours, says, regardless of their rhetoric, Tories are funded by big business and therefore have an incentive to boost migration. Labour are largely funded by trade unions and have an incentive to reduce migration. What the hardcore membership believe is irrelevant. Okay. Next super chat is, struggling with meditation. This was the one that drew in all of those Indians. Studio Reina says, Yuri Bezmenov literally said that meditation was a great way to subvert a civilization. What? What are you talking about? How is meditation a great way to subvert civilization? I don't understand that at all. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. And if that was true, it would mean that the Eastern countries have been subverted for like 5,000 years or something ridiculous. Oh, a ridiculous claim. It's not a ridiculous super chat. And if Yuri Bezmenov did say that, I'd love to know his reasoning. On Three Black Pills, a very old video, he says, is this video economic propaganda? South Korea will collapse in 2050 due to Western economic theory, which resulted in demographic suicide. It's the best case model for Western economic and isolationist militaristic theories. If the public needs to know who ruined their country, it was their economists. Kim Jong-un has achieved better results than the combined efforts of all British economists. That video, Three Black Pills, is a very, very old video with some of the ideas of elite theory in embryo, right? I mean, that's like a seven-year-old video, that, or maybe even an eight-year-old video that you're talking about there. I can't remember, but I don't seem to remember it talking about economics. I was talking about how democracy is not real in that video, if memory serves. This is also on the meditation one. Bram Zwingli says, one of the first things they teach you when you get training in an occult lodge. Okay. Ken Nahara says, this is on another very old video. It's on public opinion doesn't matter. Five lessons. He says, this doesn't help to explain the rationale behind the decisions of European leaders. Your history books explain that the barbarian invasion contributed to the fall of Rome. We are a biologically tribal. I will say, Ken, that my history books do not say that. My history books, like Arnold Toynbee's got a great line somewhere saying that Rome did not fall because of the barbarian invasions. Rome had already fallen, and the barbarian invasions were like carrion feasting on the corpse. It fell, the Roman Empire fell due to internal reasons, not due to external reasons. And if you read or buy and read my book, The Prophets of Doom, this is discussed. In fact, most powers do not fall from the outside, they fall from the inside. I mean, we're talking about mad doctrine. The USSR didn't fall because of external pressure. It fell due to internal pressure. And so it will be with the USA at one point as well. When that happens, I don't know. Anyway, he says, we are biologically tribal. And if you believe in biology, then how does a British leader defy both the rationale and the biological instincts and allow mass immigration of hostile tribes? My single conclusion is that some form of pollution, toxin, or parasite has infected Europeans and dimmed their biological instincts. Do you have any other explanation? Have Europeans suffered from some form of genetic mutation? I mean, there are other explanations. Like, for example, one of the things that the elite theorists talk about is how liberal democracy is a late-stage development that comes as a result of mass and scale, okay? And with mass and scale, the leaders have become more remote from the people. Mosca has got this passage where he talks about how medieval, like the medieval knight, for example, the medieval knight would have to like face the peasant eye to eye. He'd even have to like sit down for a pint with him. Whereas most of our leaders, apart from very stage managed kind of photo ops, don't come within 100 feet of the normal person. So they're not accountable in the same way. They're disconnected. The elites are disconnected from the people. So that's one explanation for it. There are also, I mean, like I said, the boom of truth has been very central to why people have quote unquote gone against their instincts, because the de facto wisdom since World War II has been that if you go the way of Nazi Germany, you basically destroy your society, that it's disastrous, that it will lead to terrible, terrible humanitarian disasters like the Holocaust. That is the reasoning that we have been told practically our whole lives. And there's, I mean, I think there's some truth to it. This will be unpopular. I do think there's some truth that a very, very robust blood and soil nationalism does actually result in some very unpleasant things taking place. I mean, we spent most of the show talking about Gaza and the Israel situation. I don't really like that form of very, very hardcore nationalism that we're seeing in Israel. It's unpleasant. It's not been nice to watch. It's been grotesque in parts, and it kind of rankles. You know, these things are going to have an effect. And maybe in a couple of generations' time, the Israelis will have a period of being like, maybe we shouldn't have done that. Or maybe there'll be such a thing as Israeli guilt at some point down the line. Who knows? I don't know. I also don't know what would have happened, let's say, if the Germans had won World War II, and what the future, like, would there still have been that kind of guilt thing that pervaded in the 20th century? I don't know, is the answer, Ken. Ethan Bright says, why don't you have an opinion on Israel? What? I do have an opinion on Israel. I just gave it to you. He says, I'm not talking about politics, but civilizations. Oh, okay. All right, that makes more sense. The British Empire was the most powerful, organized, and civilized empire in history. Now the British people who condemn Israel and support Ukraine. Do you think the British people would have been better off if they responded to immigration like Israel does to Palestinians? I don't condone needlessly bombing women and children. I don't think the British government should, launch a kind of genocidal attack on Birmingham or Leicester or something like this. So, no, I think we have to be more adult. I think we have to be more sensible and centered about these things. And I think we have to come up with sensible, humane, incentive-based policy in order to solve the problem. Yes, they shouldn't have come in the first place. Yes, lots of mistakes were made by successive generations of politicians. Yes, the thinking behind it was all wrong. And we can easily show that their arguments are rubbish and so on and so forth. But we also have to have good plans to put in place to, you know, deal with the problem. And it doesn't have to be done in an insane or genocidal way. For example, I talked before about how after World War II, there were absolutely huge migrations of people all around Europe. And the Allies basically ethnically sorted all the populations, back into their respective homelands. This is discussed in a book by Ian Morris called Post-War, which I recommend you take a look at. Steve Arena says, this is again on another extremely old video. Chicago school versus Austrian school, four types of libertarianism. I mean, that's, we're getting on for almost like a decade ago now for that video. He says, what do you believe is the purpose of economists in society? I don't believe in free market because it has never existed and will never exist. Milton Friedman succeeded in forming a public consensus for shareholder capitalism and establishing the terminology that would be used to justify slave labor in foreign countries, expansionist foreign policy, and the expansion of the US empire. The Dodge versus Ford Motor Company case in 1919 established shareholder supremacy, and Michigan Supreme Court's ruling effectively ended capitalism. The verdict vastly benefited academic institutions and the incentive to invest in an occupation that would solely defend this verdict from criticism formulated by economists. Well, Studio Arena, I have come to see economists basically as a function of what an empire wants to do at any given point in time. Okay. And I've talked about this. I talked about it on my appearance on Brokenomics with Dan Tubbs. I've talked about it in various videos on the channel. When empires are expanding, okay, it is when they are just getting going, they're generally protectionist, okay? So you need economists to justify the protectionism, to generate post hoc arguments for the protectionism. When empires reach what they call high noon or their zenith, i.e. when they become hegemonic, when they become a regional or global hegemon, as the British Empire did in the 19th century, as like the Mongols did in the 13th century or whenever, as various empires have done through history, as the Roman Empire did at one point, when you become hegemonic, it then behooves you to increase the zone of control using free trade arguments, because you establish a free trade zone within the areas you control. As I put it on the show with Dan Tubbs, the friends of Genghis Khan now get to trade. And anyone who's not a friend of Genghis Khan gets killed. But anybody who's within the protection of Genghis Khan is a friend of Genghis Khan. And he oversees a massive free trade zone empire, right, for the friends of Genghis Khan. The US empire is basically the same. The friends of the US empire enjoy free trade. If you're not a friend of Genghis Khan, you get sanctions, you're outside. Cuba, not a friend of Genghis Khan. Cuba, not allowed. Venezuela, not a friend of Genghis Khan. Venezuela, not allowed. So all of the countries within the US zone of control become part of the free trade network and the free trade empire. So then you need economists to justify that, whether it's Adam Smith, right, who, don't forget, Adam Smith was writing at a time of high protectionism, but he became the kind of, in vogue philosopher after he died in the period where they were trying to justify free trade and laissez-faire. They were like, oh, this Adam Smith guy made some good arguments, didn't he? Let's bring him back. Okay, and there were tons of Victorian free traders. And then, of course, when circumstances changed, and it was relevant and necessary for power to switch back to protectionist mode, lo and behold, the protectionist economists and people like John Maynard Keynes came back into vogue. And when it was time for the US empire to become the free trade zone, lo and behold, you get Milton Friedman. Right? So all of these economists are basically court philosophers justifying what power is doing right now. Okay, and invariably, the power only uses that economist to the extent that it wants to expand its zone of control. So I have a book by Milton Friedman here called The Tyranny of the Status Quo, which is basically him complaining. He wrote that book in 1983-84, right in the middle of the Reagan administration. And it's basically a book of him complaining about how, even though he was at the absolute peak of his influence and power under Reagan, actually they didn't want to do half of the stuff he wanted to do. You know, he wanted to destroy the welfare state. He wanted like a libertarian paradise, didn't he? The US government and Reagan didn't do half of that stuff. The reality is that the Reagan administration was basically being managed by Bush Sr., who was a deep state spook. So that's real. I mean, so you say, well, what's the point of Milton Friedman? Milton Friedman, he was used to justify a few things. A couple of tax cuts here and there, you know, a few deregulations, a few free trade agreements, monetarist Fed policy. All of this was Chicago school stuff, right? But they were only allowed to go so far. They weren't allowed to deconstruct the administrative state, as Steve Bannon would put it, because that wasn't in the interest of power. Okay, let's carry on. Old school monarchist says, I was fortunate to be born into a large family and attend a private boarding school. This is on why progressives fear the rise of traditionalism, a video that got a huge amount of views when I put it out. He says, I was fortunate enough to be born into a large family and attend a private boarding school. I'm studying my undergraduate degree at a private college on 13,000 acres of land. Can you explain why public schools don't seem to teach anything? I became an apprentice at 12, so I learned English, Latin, grammar, and rhetoric by then. I was married at 17, and I don't understand how most students would graduate from high school by 18. Did public schools always function like this? Since it makes no sense from a biological or educational perspective, I'd also recommend that anybody looking for a traditional life realize that you must be born into it. The first few years of development tend to dictate the rest of life. That was a good post. One thing to note is that back in the old days, of course, it was not uncommon for kids, especially working class kids, to work a couple of, maybe they do like one or two shifts down the mine, and they'll be working in the morning, and then they might go to school in the afternoon, or they might do the Monday on a shift, and then they might do Tuesday in school. So it was actually common in many places for kids to split their education and actually working a job. And then they do it like that. Up in the upper classes, I don't believe they would have split. They would have, you know, been full time in school. But of course, they were actively being trained to be the leaders, the rulers of an empire. So they were actively brought up with leadership roles in mind, and they were actually bred. And there were all sorts of practices that they did. I talked about the breaking of the ice that John Glubb talks about. You know, give an ice bath so you experience struggle and things like that. You know, discipline and caning and all this sort of stuff. All of that was to, you know, prepare you, because you might be taking a decision to take men into war one day, you know, or into battle, or you might be, you know, leading an expedition to Africa or something, you know. So, they did do it differently back then. Really, the big change with education comes when it becomes very centralized and state controlled. A lot of the British education system was run by the church, and it was decentralized. So that's why so many schools still have, either, you know, like St. John's or St. Catherine's or whatever. They tend to still maintain that kind of link with a church, but at some point they were nationalized, and there was the national curriculum established and was made mandatory. That was the big change in schooling. Some of the best sources on this are actually libertarians. I remember Murray Rothbard being very good on this topic as one example. Ethan Bright on Keir Starmer's India trade deal, the most misunderstood thing of 2025, says the BBC advertised that white women in England weren't being protected by their fathers or husbands. So I don't have an issue with Asian men having their way. That's a little bit hardcore, Ethan. I disagree with that. I think the government should protect, the inhabitants of this country. Terrible economic policy. Commitment to foreign wars that the UK had no business in, a bloated bureaucracy, and no excuse for fathers not protecting their daughters. Most of the anger seems to be coming from the white men rather than the victims. I'd assume the victims would be more upset than the spectators. The UK can be of any ethnicity if they are economically productive. If the economy is efficient, then does it matter if West Asians enjoy the exotics that England has to offer? No, I can't go along with this, Ethan Bright. That's obviously morally reprehensible, what you're saying. I don't see how that's an economic issue. You can say it's a moral issue, but it certainly isn't a financial issue, and that's why they're allowed to do it. It's obviously a disgrace what has happened, and it's moral bankruptcy, absolutely. But, it's obvious that the government should protect women and children, and frankly anybody, from psychopaths in the society, whether they're foreign or otherwise. Steely Rayner on British establishment in meltdown over Ukraine crisis says, apologies for the length of this super chat. Yeah, you've written an essay here. But why do you think that the British and the US EU propaganda is irrational? Russia is directly challenging both the Western World War II narrative and the Soviet World War II narrative. Russia seems to view the Bolsheviks as terrorists. And Stalin was overall a good leader, far better than Lenin, okay? Russia is adopting an economy that is not capitalist, socialist, or communist. It's isolationist and patriotic, in large part due to Western sanctions, okay? Russia is seeking court orders in Hong Kong and Singapore to recover seized Russian assets. Brussels must return them to avoid a complete euro crash and the EU's collapse. The US won't oppose destroying the euro either. Okay. Russia has a decree offering citizenship to those in neoliberal countries. All right. Hungary, Poland, and Romania all have historical and political reasons to reclaim regions in Western Ukraine. All right. Which side, with the British public support, if Russia announced it would execute war profiteers in London and offer a deportation service? I think they probably still side against the Russians. Anti-Russian sentiment is quite big here, in my view. I think the EU elites fear Russia ideologically, not militarily. It's common for a power to overthrow tyrannical regimes and gain support from their citizens, especially if they have a constitution. The EU elites fear the war's official end as they made generational wealth from Ukraine. However, the British establishment is probably wise enough to recognise the risk of losing power. Do you believe I'm overestimating the intelligence of the British oligarchy compared to the EU oligarchy? I mean, to be honest, England has always been the most anti-Russian country in Europe. To be honest, I still think that most of the Ukraine war was an American plot, really, to drive a wedge between Germany and Russia, the destruction of Nord Stream. Because the natural interests of Germany, especially given its energy situation, is to buy Russian gas and to make that into a kind of lasting alliance. And that's up in smoke. That's what I think Biden and co were up to. America got that out of it, and then under Trump, they're trying to walk away from the war. I mean, that's always been my view. Why do the EU leaders do what they do? I mean, God knows. God knows why any of them do what any of them do. Golden Age Puritan says, the new subscribers who did so because of this video are going to be surprised and perhaps confused. Well, that's the thing, Golden Age Puritan. They watched the video, but they didn't subscribe. I had a look at the analytics, and most of them didn't subscribe or stick around. There were a few, but most of them didn't, unfortunately. Studio Rayner on What Marx Got Right says, do you think the global managerial growth is going to stop when the population crashes? Or do you think they'll use genetic engineering to make more people? They've been using immigration. The main way of keeping the population going up and up has been immigration, hasn't it? So there we go. Are they going to use genetic engineering? I don't know about that. I honestly don't know. I don't know enough about it. I suspect there'll be moral kind of outrage. Port Film Co-op says, highly recommend people check out the new Australian nationalist documentary called Summer Nationals, that Mark Collette says is the best documentary ever made by nationalists that he's ever seen. It is on Rumble next. Okay. Inquisition Rack says, AA, have you ever seen the 1966 documentary Africa Addio about the transition of power from Europeans to Africans? It's a great watch and very controversial. No, I haven't, but that sounds good. And if we ever get to post Adam Curtis world, I'll see if I can get Horace and Simon to remind me of Africa Adio. Steve Arena says, shareholder primacy is communism. How the hell did the Michigan Supreme Court manage to end capitalism? Were the communists that organized in 1919? That is actually not the argument that James Burnham and so on make. The argument in the managerial revolution is not that it's shareholders. It is that the shareholders become the disorganized mass, and the asset managers in charge of those shareholdings, right, become the organized minority. So the shareholder becomes like, what's the word they use? Most shareholders are passive. Passive shareholders are the disorganized mass. Now, this is in a pension fund, right? Most people don't even know how their pensions are being invested. It is being done on their behalf. They are passive in the truest sense. But even in many cases, institutional investors and wealthy individuals just park their money in some kind of asset fund or whatever, and BlackRock or Vanguard or wherever do the rest. And that concentrates a lot of power in the asset manager. That is the argument that Burnham makes in the managerial revolution. So it's like classic elite theory as applied to the stock market. And Elon Musk was a case of it going the other way, of course. Elon Musk, you know, going from being took a company from being publicly owned, floated on the stock market with a managerial oversight. And he took that company, Twitter, to being monarchical, the single, the Henry Ford figure, the single tycoon, the single owner, which is much more classically kind of capitalist. He also says India was destroyed when the British left them with a stupid democracy. Did Indians want to leave the British Empire? There's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that the average Indian didn't have particularly big independence. Then I saw one thing by the British government, a report that was done in about 1919, 1920 sort of time. Viscount something. He was actually like in charge of the Raj, right? And anyway, he submitted this report saying like a nationalist sentiment in India is only at 5%, which is going to be a problem if they're going to get, because they were looking to get India off the books, basically. So wish I could remember where I saw that. JP says, I've noticed a sizable amount of people wanting to disestablish the Senate and undermine the Welsh language too. I think they might be hungry for someone to kick off something bigger. When you say a sizable amount of people, how many people is that? Rainer says, what can the BBC do? The Samsung option is the best example of nuclear blackmail. Why have a world without Israel? I really think that the Samsung option shouldn't be overdone in people's analyses of things. Right, that is just something that's rumored to be there. I don't see much evidence that it comes into that much play in people's considerations of things. Pood says, Lineker is a shitlib. Yeah, massively, massively so. But was objectively a great presenter on Match of the Day. Now we'll be stuck with diversity hires and women every week. Two sugars. Poods, they're talking about Gabby Logan being the replacement. Logan is being, hyped up as the Lineker replacement. That'll be a massive... honestly, the best thing they could do is get Shearer to do it, I reckon. The worst thing they could do would be to replace him with a woman, in my opinion. I will say, too, that podcast where it's Gary Lineker, Alan Shearer and Micah Richards is a pretty good podcast. They have a good laugh on there. I don't agree with his politics, but it's objectively a good football show. I liked watching the, I mean, I don't watch current football, but they did this series where they were picking their best 11s through history, like best Italian players or best right backs ever type thing. And I really enjoyed watching those. And it's, yeah, it's pretty funny. Mika Richards is an absolute clown as well, but it's kind of fun to watch. There's a weirdly good dynamic on that show. So anyway, AKS99 says, how would you rate the influence of particular group on UK politics on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the most? How does this compare with the US? In the US, it's a 9 or a 10. In the UK, I'd say it's more like a 4 or a 5. Maybe a 5 or a 6, something like that. It's more low-key. It's less in your face. It's kind of there, but it's not as extreme as it is in the American case. And certainly, when it comes to the issue of support for that country in the Middle East, people are a lot more outspoken in this country about that than they have been in America. Although, to be fair, there's been a lot of very outspoken people in America as well. Raina says, I've yet to see any anti-Israel people suggest anything that would have an impact. If it was authentic, then 10 people to stop paying taxes. Lewis Shaw Moffitt says, AA, are you aware of Jevons' paradox for economics as it applies to technological advancement? Well, I'm aware of Jevons. He was one of those laissez-faire economists from the Victorian period who I mentioned earlier on. And I've got a, William Stanley Jevons. I've got a lot of his books here because when I wrote the book, Defenders of Liberty, I got pretty into Jevons and his arguments. So I'm vaguely aware of the Jevons paradox, but I am not aware of how it applies to technological advancement. So you'll have to refresh my memory because it's quite a long time ago now. Daniel Sweet says, I'm looking forward to living in a vibrant early 2000s Love Actually-esque Britain under Sir Keir Starmer, as celebrity leftists are removed from view. Well, we'll see about that. Raina says, there's two reasons to virtue signal about Israel. It's profitable to talk about, or they want to be morally superior. Israel benefits from anti-Israel sentiment anyway. Who truly cares about Palestine? I do think that those people, I think generally, people don't like the idea of harm being done to children, right? People don't like that as a concept. And then actually seeing the images and so on does have an effect on people, right? So I don't think that they are entirely kind of cynical or entirely without. I do think that they care about that, and it doesn't necessarily have to be empty or hollow too. I think it comes from the fact that Israel are doing that. Okay. I mean, you know, that it is what it is. So I do think that people do truly care about that. Whether they care about Palestine as an actual cause, whether they care about the Palestinians having a state or so on, that is more questionable. I have a book by these two leftists here called Empire by Negri and Hart, Hart and Negri. And there's another one by them. Anyway, in one of those books, they quote this guy saying, like, look, if there truly was a Palestinian state established, the left would lose interest because it's the struggle that matters, right? The struggle. So there's a weird kind of acknowledgement that they don't actually like want to reach the end state. They're actually happy in the struggle state. Once you actually reach the goal, the leftists will not be interested, for example, in making the Palestinian state a success or running it or anything like that. They're in it for the, like, to get het up about injustice and all of that sort of stuff. That's what leftists are like. Okay. So there is a kind of, there is a level, I guess, of disingenuousness there from some leftists, because what they're really into is not Palestine. It's moral indignation, feeling like they are fought against injustice and that kind of burning struggle thing, right? most leftists in all times and places have been like that. There would have been people who were into the French Revolution, but then once the revolutionary regime took over, either lost interest in actually running the place, or they lost it, or they were killed in the reign of terror or whatever, because they turned against the leaders or whatever. Those sorts of figures have always been there on the left, because what they're into is the struggle, not the result. Begbie says, Kanye's song marks the beginning of the end of Boomer Truth. Does this mean we'll get the third book in the trilogy? Eventually, yes, eventually. But I'm still very trepidatious about Starmer, to be honest, in general. Like, you know, that woman who was put in jail for tweets that she made over Southport, she had her appeal denied today, and she's still in jail for sending a tweet. Right. So let's not. That is still the environment that everybody's operating under. Based Future says the date has passed. You got the cigar in spirit. I mean, anybody still thinks otherwise. Well, you know, you guys can make your own minds up. But if you think the woke was not put away, then I disagree. Lewis Shaw Moffat says the society is governed by the stories that we tell ourselves. IA. It's not just the top, middle, or bottom that defines it. We are where we are by the stories we tell. Truth and reality must be the story. Well, truth and reality has seldom been the story historically, though. Myth has usually been stronger than the truth. Page one of Evola's Revolt Against the Modern World. Also, Reflections on Violence by George Sorel talks about myth. So I'm not sure that truth and reality have ever been the story. So it may be utopian to expect that, Lewis. Raina says, I use Super Chat because comments are filled with bots. Regardless of the channel, I don't think AI has helped Google at all. Okay. Caleb says, I mean, there has been a spate of where as soon as a video goes live at 9 a.m., there's been sex bots spamming up the chat. And every morning I go in there 2 minutes afterwards and ban them all. There were like six or seven on every video. That is kind of annoying. Caleb says, I've enjoyed your videos on how top-down propaganda works. It's on that front, by the way, there's a guy called Andy Edwards who runs like a music channel or a channel talking about popular culture and music. And he is set to reply to my video on hip hop. He's set to reply to it either later today or tomorrow. Let me have a look at that. I might give him a share. Andy Edwards. And he... yes, tomorrow. Look, I'll share my screen here. He is going to reply to me. Did this man destroy rock music? And he's pointing to Doug Morris there. I'm fascinated to see what he's going to say, because I thought I laid out a pretty good case personally. Okay, let's carry on. Caleb says, oh yeah, so I enjoyed your videos about how top-down propaganda works. It's amazing how many people believe prop doesn't work on them. It works to some degree on all of us. Being self-aware is better than a faux belief in individualism. Absolutely, Caleb. And understanding the ways that you yourself have been propagandized and brainwashed and then kind of undoing that is half the battle. One of the weirdest things about leftists is that all of their stuff, leftists constantly talk about brainwashing and propaganda techniques. But in their mind, it's their enemies who have been brainwashed. They never see their own brainwashing. Lewis Shaw Moffat says, Jevons paradox, William Stanley Jevons, that is, paradox, simply puts it that when you make an advancement in efficiency via a technological improvement, you will use more resources and not less. Yeah, that is actually true, Lewis Shaw Moffat. And it's described in better detail, I think, by Austrian, well, the Austrians adapted that idea in their idea of the chain of production, right? So when you get automation, every part, every stage of the automation is using up more and more, it's more capital intensive, right? For more round, what they call roundabout and more capitalistic production techniques. Yeah, that is true. Right. And the example is, think of the amount of workers it used to take to get ice from the mountains, right? Back when they used to be people who used to go and hack ice from the mountains, right? And then they transport that ice to hotels and things to put in their drinks, okay? Well, that would have been a couple of hundred, you know, 10,000 jobs, say, something like that. But now think of the structure of production that goes into making a modern freezer, for example. Well, all of the parts, all of the screws, all of the factories, right? I mean, it's absolutely a fact that it does use more resources and not less. So Jevons was right. The Austrians put it that way, more capitalistic, more roundabout methods of production. Marcos588 says, speaking of football, any chance for another stream of you and Furious shooting the proverbial about it? The Italia stream was great fun back in the day. Horace actually mentioned to me after last week's show that if I ever want to do a casual stream about football, that he's up for a bit of football chat. I don't know if George Adams is still around. We used to do the WWYD streams with me, but he was a bit of a footy fan as well. You know, we'd just do some 90s nostalgia stuff. That I do that over on AA Culture, obviously. But the trouble is, I've been very busy this year. So I've not done much gaming or culture content because I've been just busy in life in general. Coney says, thoughts on the futurist art revival among dissident artists, like with the recent Fuemi Art Gallery in New York opening? I have no thoughts about that whatsoever, Coney, I'm afraid. Studio Rainer says, do you think accelerationism is a belief held by elites in the tech sector? I do not think that that is a belief held by most of them. Possibly Peter Thiel, who has read quite a lot of kind of dissident literature and so on. Possibly he, like I know for a fact that he would have read Nick Land, for example. So maybe Peter Thiel and some of his friends. Who's that guy who follows me? Marcus Andreessen. He unfollowed me and then he followed me again, by the way, Andreessen did. On Twitter, so there we are. Lewis Shaw Moffat says, myths are stories, AA. You disagree with me. Whether they are true or not isn't my main thrust, but that if you don't relate to the truth reality, you get a serious problem, e.g. the UK. Yeah, absolutely, okay. We were agreeing and just not understanding, like my disagreement was superficial. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The myths and stories are really, really important to how people perceive themselves. And if you don't buy into the current story being told, then the society has a real problem. And that's the issue, is that there's no story for young men to believe in right now. UTIS4321 says, the Prime Minister of Israel stated recently, if Israel fails, the world will fall shortly after, a not-so-veiled reference to the Samson option. I mean, they can try it, but I just don't believe that's going to happen. I think it's much more likely that Israel will just implode in some way. You know, there's this weird, speaking of myths, there's this weird thing that there's like the curse of 80 years or something where, you know, they've never had a country or a state that's lasted longer than 80 years. And I think that 80 years is up in 3 years. Right. So they're hurtling towards, like, they're speed running the end game right now, it seems to me. So maybe, I mean, who knows what's going to happen? Who knows? I have no idea. We have been in uncharted waters for quite a long time as it pertains to that. All right. I think that'll do. That was a lot of super chats today. Why is a guy saying a rare miss by AA? What's a rare miss? Well, what's the rare miss? Hailing tree. What's the miss? Come on. I don't know. He's not going to say no. I don't know what he thinks the miss is, but...
Yeah, I mean, you know.
There you go. What do you think they mean when they say if Israel fails, the West foils? It seems very direct to me. Studio Arena, what I think is they're basically trying to use... They need an argument that Israel is central, not ancillary. They need an argument to say that we are the first line of defense and we belong to the West. It's a kind of persuasion tool, right? Their big weakness in our politics is that, you know, well, most people will say, well, I'm not from there. It's a foreign country. Why should I care? Right. So they need an answer to that question. And that basically is an answer to that question. So there we go. Somebody said there was a member chat. Anglo Eddie says, hello, AA. As a former academic, what do you mean former? I'm a current academic. I'm not former anything. What's your opinion on attending a university to study a liberal art like theology? Would it be a waste of time? Well, Anglo Eddie, the ultimate question is, are you really, really interested in theology? Is it a burning passion of yours? Would you forever feel that if you did not go and do your theology degree, that you'll be kicking yourself down the line thinking, I wish I should have done it. I've always been interested in theology. I could have, should have, would have. That's really the question. If you really feel like your interest in theology is sufficient for you to devote 3 years of serious study to it, then you should do it without question. If you're just doing it as a lark, or if you're just doing it because you want to get a job or something, you're better off just going to get a job. I'll be honest. You're probably better off having 3 years work experience than getting a theology degree. But that's a question for you to answer, ultimately. So there you go. That guy never came back. He never said what the rare miss is. He never said what the rare miss is. Oh, well. Studio Rainer says you have 9,000 views on YouTube and 5,000 likes. Did Blair boost this channel? There have been some quite unusual things recently, Studio Rainer. I don't know if these are the recent influx of Indians on those couple of videos or what's going on, but who knows? Who knows? Maybe magic is real. I have no idea who these extra people are. One thing I will say is that they're certainly not in the chat, as far as I can see. It doesn't look like the chat is going really, really fast. So what those, you know, maybe it's a glitch on YouTube or something. Whatever. I'm certainly not seeing like the chat whizzing by. So that suggests that there's a glitch or something like that. I'd have thought. All right. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be back tomorrow for reviewing Adam Curtis. Catch my Steven Spielberg video in the morning and also look out for that video by Andy Edwards. I'm really interested to see it myself. Bye all.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.